Good evening. My name is Robert Taverner. I direct the Cities Programme at the LSC. And this evening we have the first of three public lectures by eminent teachers attached to the LSC Cities Programme. This evening, of course, while you're here, is Adam Caruso. On the 14th of November, Ricky Burdett, who's recently hot foot back from the Venice Biennale, which he directed this year. And on the 5th of December, Professor Ed Soldier, who's here with us this evening, an eminent geographer planner who teaches at UCLA as well. So the intention over this term is to give you three flavors of the Cities Programme, or at least those people who teach on it. This evening, Adam is going to talk about specific objects, but I'd just like to give a very brief introduction to him first. Adam is Canadian. He was born he has actually given his date of birth, which I don't think is the right thing to give you, so I'm not going to. But he studied at McGill University in Montreal, and then came to the UK in London, where he worked with Florian Bagel for a number of years, before then joining Arup Associates. I believe it was at Arup Associates that he met Peter St. John, his partner in Caruso St. John. They came to fame, of course, with a series of art gallery buildings, the new art gallery in Walsall, a £16 million project that was open to considerable acclaim in 2000. Since then, a series of smaller galleries, the bigger ones spawned the smaller ones, but very prestigious within London, the new Gagosian Gallery in Britannia Street, King's Cross. And they're currently working on the Victoria and Albert Museum at the Museum of Childhood in Bethnal Green. And on site, I believe, or just about started on site, is the new Centre for Contemporary Art in Nottingham. So they don't only do things in London. As well as developing a practice that many of us admire in terms of their work, Adam and Peter have been teaching actively through the development of their partnership. Firstly, at the University of North London, where they taught for a decade, and then from 1999 to 2001 at the Academy of Architecture in Mendrisio in Switzerland. It was whilst he was teaching there, and I was teaching at the University of Bath, that he came to my attention, and I was fortunate in convincing him to come and teach as a professor of architecture at Bath University, where he taught for 3 years and had an extraordinary impact on our second degree students. Extraordinary in a positive sense, of course. When I moved to the LSC, I was very keen to get him teaching here as well, and was delighted when he was able to take up a visiting professorship with the Cities Programme last December. So he's just starting his second year here. What I enjoy, I suppose, about Adam and Peter's work is the way they look at, I suppose, in a sense, ordinary things afresh. And whilst they turn that ordinariness into something rather special, it's not in the flamboyant way that we've become rather used to, perhaps, by leading architects in the late 20th century, early 21st. They study buildings, spaces, very, very carefully. And they find that special quality and characteristic, which they then turn into their own and invest it with a new magic. And that's what we're looking forward to seeing something about this evening. Evan Caruso.
Thank you for that generous introduction. Oh, you're doing it.
Art.
Thank you. Mm. Okay. I'm I have to find a keyboard here. This lecture is going to show five projects, and they're all very recent, and only one of them is built now, but they'll all be built. So it's trying to, in a way, be very open about what we're talking about and doing in the office now, because it always changes, obviously. Peter and I are quite different people, but one thing that we have in common is that we both get easily bored by repeating ourselves. So we're always thinking, well, where can we go now? But the thing that, and this idea of work developing and changing is something I think we've always really enjoyed. And the idea that one can be an eclectic architect, to me, isn't something. You think? I mean, as soon as I put the, I'll put the first slide on, I think it'll.
It's
not so necessary. To me, eclecticism is about having a wealth of knowledge, a erudition about a subject, and then making informed decisions about what part of that knowledge to deploy in a particular situation. So to me, being an eclectic architect is a really positive thing. But of course, modernism, or a kind of particular take on modernism, which I don't think was really a very accurate reflection of what actually happened, or actually what was being discussed, say, in the interwar period or in the post-war period, that kind of the idea of being eclectic probably would have rubbed the wrong way, you know. Although I think there were many different things happening at that time, but certainly great architects were eclectic. They had many arrows in their quiver, you know. So someone like Schinkel, he could do a fantastic Gothic project or a fantastic classical project. And closer to home, someone like William Wilkins, whose maybe his masterpiece, Downing College, we've been working in for the last 5 years. The project we're doing at Downing, one part of it is to restore and remake his only existing neoclassical interior. But actually, there are several of his Gothic interiors that still exist, even at New College in Cambridge. So, you know, I think one has to. Yeah, I guess for us, it's a way of responding in a kind of specific way to specific projects. And I guess that's why this lecture is called Specific Objects. I'll try and get back on track now. This is a photograph of an exhibition that we had at the AA last year, and we're now working on a book which kind of follows on from the ideas of that exhibition. And this is just one kind of cozy corner of the exhibition, and you can see kind of a range of material, some of it by us, some of it by other people, and I think it shows the idea of the exhibition. The exhibition was called Cover Versions, and it was about this idea that you can't invent things anew, but whatever you pick up from its sort of 2,000-year history of Western architecture, you refresh by working it through your own sensibility. And I think Peter and my work, what's consistent about it is that it has a sensibility. There's a kind of consistent sensibility. There's a consistent range of interests we have. But the things that we like change and get broader and broader. After 17 years of practice, you know, now we're starting to think, now we're ready to tackle classicism, for instance, or Gothic, maybe, or modernism, all of those things. And to do it in more and more of a kind of self-evident way, and confidence that kind of our experience of how we work and our kind of sensitivity to the situation in which we're working will assure that it isn't a ridiculous choice, at least, that there is something relevant about making that choice, about the kind of architecture that one is interested in for that project, and then that one will, through handling it, make it one's own. That's something I've always told students. You know, you can copy a project, and if you do it in good faith, it will become transformed into something else. Okay, I'm going to just show a few images. In preparing that exhibition, I spent a few days at the V&A RIBA drawings collection, which were very, very pleasant days spent, I must say. And I selected things that we would show alongside our work. And they were things that we were trying, they weren't sort of vague things that we liked, they were things that had specific, that we had specifically discussed in reference to the projects we were showing in the exhibition. So for instance, we had four plates from Owen Jones's Grammar of Ornament, and these are ones that are particularly relevant to the Museum of Childhood project. Just incredible things. In the first editions, I think they were the absolute cutting edge of printing technology to make these in the 1860s, I think. And of course, the RIBA and the V&A have many beautiful copies of them. I also went through several full sets of working drawings by Philip Webb, who's one of my absolute architectural heroes, a guy who had a real ethical position and turned down a lot more work than he took on. And these, this is the, I think it's a quarter scale, so 1 to 50 elevation of clouds at East Noyles, which doesn't exist anymore, but it's one of his great houses. And so we had a number of his working drawings interspersed amongst the working drawings for one of our houses. A bit presumptuous, maybe, but the point we were trying to make was he was absolutely fastidious about how he described his projects, and he did almost all of these drawings himself. He never had more than one assistant, who were really only allowed to trace the drawings for sight. But he didn't leave anything to his contractors, even though he always worked with the same contractors. He drew absolutely everything at full scale, and it was kind of a relief to me to see that even then people were as kind of anal retentive and neurotic as that in order to control the process. This is very nice how we got this, but this a print of this amazing photograph by John Sverkowski of Adler and Sullivan's Guarantee Building in Buffalo. Sverkowski was the first curator of photography at MoMA, and he was a fine photographer as well. And there's a very nice book called The Idea of Louis Sullivan, and these are just amazing. And we phoned up his gallery, and they phoned him up, and he said, "Yeah, give them what they want," and they gave us the most amazing scans of a number of his photographs, which we have now. And Sullivan is quite an obsession of ours, and increasingly so. And we went with our Harvard students last year to visit this building in Buffalo, a very glamorous trip for the Harvard students. And the building is even more shocking than you expect. It's like, on the one hand, an incredible visceral lump of clay. It's incredibly red. But then on the other hand, it has the most delicate and masterful surface decoration, incredibly delicate. The technology of these terracotta panels is incredible, just covering it like a reptilian skin, and it really does feel like a skin stretched. And it's, of course, a kind of fireproofing and a cladding to the steel structure. The more you look at Sullivan's buildings, the greater they are. And to design ornament like this, that's beyond our ability, unfortunately, now. We had this photograph, which is it's maybe not the best. It wasn't exactly what we were looking for, but it's what we could get. But it's a photograph of Frederick Law Olmsted's Rockwood Estate in New York. And it's one of his great kind of landscape structures and landscape designs. Another thing we've been looking at a lot, specifically in terms of a kind of rural suburban housing project, which I'll show you in a moment. Very beautiful photograph. And this old photograph of Alberti's fantastic facade of Santa Maria Novella in Florence, kind of showing that just a facade can be absolutely revolutionary architecture. And the idea that this facade, which is very, very thin for 15th century technology, is this kind of this idea of a picture of structure, and was a kind of incredibly influential idea of how to make a facade to a building that didn't have a facade. So it is only a facade, Alberti's project, which leads me on to the first project I'm going to talk about. So this is the Museum of Childhood in Bethnal Green, which has been part of the Victoria and Albert Museum since it moved there in the 1870s. The structure of this building was the original V&A. It was the South Kensington Museum, which was built after 1851 exhibition. And then when they started the what's now the Henry Cole wing of the V&A, they moved the structure out east for the poor people, to educate the poor people. And they gave it a new elevation by J.W. Wild, who also did work at the main V&A building. And as typical with English cultural buildings, they ran out of money before they finished it in 1870. So the main structure has been clad in this kind of Roman bath kind of enclosure. But the forecourt, and this is Cambridge Heath Road over here, they never finished. And it was meant to have a colonnade, like a cloister around it, and a tea room and a lecture room and all of the kind of foyer facilities that a public building requires, but they were never built. But this is, we've been working on this project for 6 years, I think. First did a master plan, and then did a kind of restructuring project for the interior of the building, and we're now remedying this problem with the front of the building, demolishing this lean-to, which you see here, which has the toilet and a very mean entrance, and not like the original project, but trying to give a front to this building. Just talk a bit about the building. So this is the building. This is the addition, which is it's almost finished now here. And the first part of our project, forget this, was to kind of stabilize this. It's a listed building, obviously. This cast iron structure was a proprietary cast iron structure, so it was available from a catalog and then just put together. Incredibly delicate. You could never do it today because of fire and things like that. So we did a very light restoration project on the structure, a color concept for the building. You can't see it in the photographs, but actually it's not white. It's different shades of from red to pink. And a test project to reinstall this wing of the museum. Cleared out the central hall and made these large pieces of furniture for the reception desk and the shop and the cafe. Restored this mosaic floor, which is the same as the floor in many of the rooms of the V&A and was made by women prisoners. It was a kind of to improve them, I suppose, morally. And then this is the part of the exhibition which we reinstalled. This is their world-famous Doll's House collection. It is one of the great collections of toys and things about childhood. And it's very, very popular. They get something like 180,000 people a year, 90 kids arriving at the same time regularly during term time, but also scholars coming from all over the world. So there's a study collection as well. So you have both of these things. So this is what we're doing now, and it's going to be open in 8 weeks, apparently. I'm not so sure about that, but it's substantially done. So we've demolished the lean-to structure, and then we've put a new, much bigger porch onto the front, and we've redesigned the forecourt so that you can enter in a smooth, gentle slope from Cambridge Heath Road into the building, because there's all sorts of changes of level now. And really, I've sort of digressed on this. What we were interested in doing is making a new building which has explicit connections to the kind of structural picture of this kind of basilica that's behind, which has a color connection to it, but then has architectural themes which are obviously connected to that, but I guess are also a little bit different. It's not a brick addition. That would have been a bit depressing, maybe. So it's a very taut box, and the cladding, which is in kind of very imperial selection of stones that come from England, but also from China and India, quartzites, porphyries, and limestones, they're applied like marquetry onto the surface. So it's completely flat, and the marquetry is organized with this trabeated structure, and then infill, which is based on a kind of early Renaissance illusionistic pattern. So, you know, the reference to facades like Alberti's Santa Maria Novella, it's obvious, it's absolutely explicit, the reference. So the building, instead of having sort of 2 meters of space for the 90 kids, it gives you 5.5 or 6 meters of depth, a generous way down. So the toilets are downstairs. There's a new lift so you can get to all the levels from one place. And then the lower ground floor, which was originally gallery space, we've converted into a big education facility. Because it's not a basement, it's just lower ground. So that's the section. And then this is substantially built now, but this sort of hall, which has some connection to the lightness of the main space in the existing building, with green paneling, because it's a red building, so you go in and it's green. There's no white in this building. Very rich and amazing. It's done now, an amazing terrazzo floor. And then you go down the stairs to a kind of cellar space, which has a terrazzo floor, and the toilets and the entrance to the education room. And gold toilets and things like that. It's all very Victorian. This is a detail of the facade, and it's now substantially built. It is incredible. These pieces of quartzite are like slabs of steak. That's what they look like. They're amazing. They're very sensuous and kind of corporeal, I guess. And these patterns, which are made in the simplest of way. And then some windows, which are just flush and are equivalent with the stone. You don't know how thick anything is, because in the end, you don't see the thickness of anything. It's just like a surface wrapped. But actually, the stones are self-supporting. They're quite thick, actually. But that's luxury. You'll never notice. You'll never know that. Only we know that. And that's an early prototype of one of the panels. The joints are 3 mil wide. And the contractors are saying, this is impossible, there's no tolerance. But of course there is tolerance, it's just that the stone has to fit together perfectly. It can move on the concrete shell. What do they want, huh? Okay. Second project is this project in Nottingham, which we won in a competition about 2.5 years ago. It's a really special project. It's a project to give proper space for 3 existing galleries in Nottingham. Nottingham has what's now called Nottingham Trent, but used to be Nottingham Poly, which is one of the biggest and really powerful tradition art school, especially in performance art. And it still is the case, and there's a very strong local art scene of very ambitious young artists who don't want you to ever call them local artists. So Nottingham Trent has 2 galleries. And then there's Angel Row Gallery, which is run by the City of Nottingham, which in the last 6 or 7 years has really gained an international reputation, despite the fact it's only 300 square meters above the library. But they've had fantastic contemporary art shows and artist-curated shows. So the building we're working on is a new building to house the kind of renewed and expanded program of these institutions. So it's very nice. We're working with both universities and the city. Nottingham is an incredibly effective city. The politicians and the planners have been impressively dynamic. We've never really experienced this before to this degree. And the interview, the way they did their competition was quite amazing, that they wanted to have an architect in order to develop the program with them. So it was very conceptual, an incredibly long interview, like 2 hours long. And we got the project. And then we started visiting spaces with the curators and developing a brief. And even before that, we noticed that all the best spaces for performance art, all the best institutions for performance art, like the Worcester Group and places like the Kitchen, downtown New York, they either were in existing spaces or they didn't even have spaces at all. And they liked to be nomadic, and they liked the kind of friction between where they were making the work and the idea of the work to be part of making the work. And also, we didn't find any institutions where they really successfully combine visual and performance art, although increasingly the two are totally overlapped, and you have artists like Mark Wallinger, say, who really is doing time-based and visual arts. So it seemed like a good moment. And this is a photograph, it's a great photograph, of 112 Green Street at the end of the 60s, when people like Matta Clark were associated with the space, when his restaurant with his friends' food was downstairs from this space. Who knows what they're doing, but it's a performance in one of the kind of paradigmatic downtown sound spaces. The site is also amazing. Nottingham is a very beautiful city. I had only visited it once before, with the center of the city on that side, and then this part of the city called the Lace Market, which was the engine for Nottingham's wealth in the 19th century, when they started to produce lace mechanically and took the work away from people making it by hand. And the Lace Market is uncannily like Soho in New York. It is these cast iron warehouse buildings. It's very tough. 12 years ago it was derelict, but now it's home of Nottingham Loft Living, and you can't buy a flat there, and it's very expensive. And there's decent restaurants and lots of places to drink. And our site is just on the last site of the Lace Market. So it's, the Lace Market is on this sandstone escarpment, and our site is kind of bridging from the southernmost street of the Lace Market down to the kind of the flood valley of the river. So it's kind of an incredible position in the town. It's a site that used to have the town hall, which was then demolished to build a railway tunnel, and we're basically building in this hole, which is filled with junk, which we've just finished moving. That's Victorian infrastructure. And the And I guess what's amazing about the site is that it's so topographically challenging that I guess our first idea was we could make a building that was a bit like a factory or an industrial building that somehow was regular but had to accommodate its site. And by doing that, we would get this range of spaces that you find in industrial buildings, say. So the difference in level from the high pavement, which is the first street of the Lace Market, and Cliff Road, which is underneath here, is about 11 meters, and our building takes place between those two levels. And clearly you can have top light on the top level, but you can't have top light in the lower levels. And that's how the spaces kind of find their place and their character in the building. So this is a section. It's a building that's more underground than above ground. This is like the section through the model that you just saw, but this is a slightly more informative section. The high pavement here, the unexcavated caves, which we can't go near. Nottingham is all sandstone caves that were dug out by hand, by sort of outlaws and other sorts of people. And then this top-lit level of galleries, which you arrive at from high pavement. And then there's a mezzanine level with education rooms and offices. And then the second main level has another space at the south where you can enter. And then this massive cave-like space was built deep into the rock. And that's like another kind of gallery space. Clearly no natural light, but really big and rough. The part of the building that's in the ground is concrete, and the superstructure is steel. The plans. So interesting, but this upper yard, which is at the crossing of high pavement, and this stairs, which we're making wider again and realigning. So it's a very important crossing in this part of the city. It's way down, and then you can continue going down and go up. So the building is a bit like a motorway structure that allows you to get between different levels in the city, which the planners absolutely engage with, and then were really helped us win battles with our neighbors. We have some rather unpleasant neighbors here. The middle floor, and then the lower floor where you can enter as well through a kind of artist's cafe and down into the big gallery space, which will be the main space for performance. And the level below is the servicing level with loading and plant. So this is some model shots of what it would be like. So this is at this crossing point between High Pavement and Garner's Hill. You enter under this rather large canopy, which luckily we've gone out to tender and it's on budget because we were under a lot of pressure to make it smaller. All that the project managers would always say, can't you make that canopy a bit smaller? It looks a bit big. But the idea is that when you're here, before you enter the building, you already feel like you're in the building. It's contemporary art inside, so maybe you are scared to go in, but you've sort of experienced a bit already, and then you can continue on or go in. And it's like a slice through the building, looking into the first gallery, looking into the reception, and through to another gallery. This is a typical gallery on this ground floor level, top lit, very influenced by a fantastic gallery from the 70s in Malmö, Sweden, by Claes Anselm. These are cassettes are made with very thin plywood, so it's like house cards interlocked, filtering the top light into these spaces. And then the big space downstairs, which is in situ concrete, big, big beams because we're having to carry loads from above with the ductwork exposed, with curtains which can be deployed to kill the acoustic in the space. So this is in, like, if there was a performance with the bleacher seats deployed, but this is, say, if there was a Douglas Gordon show, Jekyll and Hyde. And then looking the other way through to the other entrance from Lower Yard through the cafe, and then the south-facing terrace, and then on to the river flood, of the river, and the train station, etc., beyond. And then the facade. I mean, even at the competition, we had this idea that we could clad the building in a way that connects with the 19th century warehouse buildings, but also the idea of lace, maybe. And indeed, that's what we're doing. These are one of many, many contact sheets we've made visiting the collection that Nottingham Trent have of Nottingham lace. So we had an endless choice, which is always difficult. And in the end, we chose, let's see if it's on here, lace 007 JPEG up there. So that's how we're using it. We have these scalloped precast panels, which are full height on the building, between 7 and 11 meters high. And the lace is almost like a frost pattern, which is going up these joint capping pieces. And that's not everywhere on the building, but it's in important positions in the building. You'll see it's already quite ornate, the facade, but it becomes even more ornate. And we're now doing experiments about how to cast this. It's no problem casting it in the concrete. One way is that we do a 3D model of the lace and then get a computer-driven milling machine to do a positive from which we make the mold. But another way, which is what we're pursuing at the moment, is to get someone to make the lace big with big needles and big thread. We have an artist friend in Hamburg who's happy to do it. And then just make the mold from the lace. So it's absolutely physical transfer. We'll see if it works. So this is how it's made. These are these big precast panels. The bottom of the building has a black terrazzo base, so you don't get too close to the sensitive bits. The model. So this is a major window looking at this thing called Weekday Cross. So above that window, the facade is completely elaborated with the lace pattern. So this is the way up Garner's Hill steps from the Lower Yard. And that's the big canopy. And the building within the city with the lace market beyond. Okay. This is a project that we won in a competition quite a few months ago now, and the city is working out how to proceed. This is not the project here. This is the Cathedral of Bellinzona. The competition is for a concert hall and museum in Ascona in the Ticino, this Italian part of Switzerland. And Ascona was really a fishing village, and it still is almost like a fishing village, but it's well known for all sorts of reasons, and it has an amazing position at the head of Lago Maggiore. Bellinzona is about 20 minutes drive away from Ascona, and Bellinzona is the capital of the Ticino, and it has the full complement of things that a city, a town would have. So it has this cathedral, which gives a kind of focus to the centre of the town. It has a train station, all of those things, things that Ascona doesn't have. So our idea for this project was to make a building that gives Ascona this kind of terminus structure, which gives a focus to the centre of the town. The site that they chose for the competition was excellent. It's just on the edge of the pedestrian zone. Our building is the black thing over there. So just south of that, it's all pedestrianized. The piazza is along here. It's a kind of open boardwalk looking south to Italy along, across Lago Maggiore, totally encircled by the Alps. It's incredible. And the building, the site is above an existing 500 car park. So it is the terminus of the town. It's where you arrive to Ascona and come up. And at the moment, it's just a site. And I think putting a big building gives a kind of symbolic and structuring, gives the building a structuring role in the town. And from a distance, the scale of the building doesn't, although tectonically it has connections to the buildings along the lake, but the building is obviously about the region. It isn't about a 5,000-person town. It's about this region, and the scale of the building is kind of about being in this river valley surrounded by the snow-topped mountains. So that's it. It's kind of in a place where there's a few monumental buildings. Over here is Collegio Papio, which is a very important private school. And that, and it's at the end of the main road in to the lake. And this is the main church, which doesn't really have a public space associated with it. And our idea for the building was really that the internal organization would be all about its position, about being at the head of the town, and when you're in the building, looking down back at the town and to the lake. So it's arranged like a classic opera house, I suppose. The south layer of the building is the foyer which is moving up the building, and then behind it are the different facilities. And it wasn't easy. The site is not quite big enough to do it, so it wasn't so easy to organize the building that way. We were the only of the competition entries to do it that way. So this is the ground floor, but then the first floor, which is a museum space, which can either be like a Kunsthalle or for collection galleries, still has this foyer space with the escalator going past and a bar. So you're always in front of those windows looking back. That's that space, which could also be used, because it's a conference facility, so it could also be used for showing cars, say, as well as they have a fantastic collection of art. The museum in Ascona was established by Harold Zeman, and it has a beautiful collection. And then the building is really about what happens above that. Those floors are really like a plinth which raises the main space of the building, the 1,200-seat concert hall and its foyers above the eaves level of the town. This is a Baroque interior, obviously, but the idea of an interior which is kind of very sculptural and theatrical, and that the foyers of our building could be like this, but also that the concert hall could be like this. So here's the section. So you can see how this ground and first floor are really like a plinth. So then you're above the height of the city, and then above that you have these kind of sheets of concrete hanging down. And you can see them hanging down like that to form the foyers, but also to form the main room. And in plan, you can see how the building is cut away, so at the top it's just the volume of the room that you're seeing. So this is a view of the west-facing foyer. So these are this is what happens with the cuts from the outside. They're kind of hanging, so they're like these billowing draperies, and the concert hall is on this side, and the spatiality of the hall has a consistency with the foyer, so it also is made by these billowing sheets of concrete. And then the outside of the building is also quite Baroque. This is a rather old picture of Valpeccia, where they mine marble, which is about 20 kilometers north of the site. I was there this summer. They indeed still mine marble there. So the front of the building is made in in-situ concrete, which is rich in the marble aggregate from Valpeccia, and the outside of the building then would be bush hammered to expose the aggregate. So the overall shape of the building is like this kind of coring that you use to get the material out of the out of the mountain, but then at a closer distance, the kind of mineral quality of the aggregate is kind of brought alive by the light off the lake and off the mountains. And this is the view back from the foyers, over the town to the lake, and the building in the town, looking towards the town, and this is the Collegio Papia. Okay. This is a very different project. This is the only project, I guess they're all urban in a way, but this is the most explicitly project that has a master plan to it, I suppose. This is a project we've been working on for about a year and a half in a town called Villeneuve-d'Ornans, which is about 10 kilometers south of Bordeaux. There's a huge population growth in the southwest of France. It's very, the climate and connections with the TGV, and it's a very popular place to live, and the center of Bordeaux has become quite expensive. So there's a lot of the big house builders in France are building in Bordeaux and Toulouse, where we're doing another project. This is, our project is an extension to this town, which is not really a town, it's a rural community, I suppose. This is looking south from our site, and then looking north, quite beautiful. These are old gravel pits which have filled up to become ponds, and a golf course will be built beyond here. And our project is this. This is the town. It's not very impressive, but we're building an extension to the town on 18 hectares of land, and then after that there will be a 56 hectare project on the other side of the road, which isn't our project. Who knows if it'll happen, but that's the plan. So we're making a kind of suburb to a town which is bigger than the town. It's clearly about Bordeaux, not about Villeneuve. We did another project first, but then we discovered with our local architect, who hadn't been too sharp at the beginning, that there's a very strict urban plan, a very bad urban plan, which we found is typical in France, which requires what they call maison pavillonnaire. So you need to have detached houses with 8 meters to any of their property lines. So you cannot build up any continuity or anything. It's just houses after houses. And then there's an artificial line, and in the south of the site you can go a bit taller. So these are small apartment buildings which are ground floor plus 3, and the north part of the site is ground floor plus 1. And the amount of parking you need is inhuman. If you're not, like, to get the parking in, is that's always the problem with French housing projects, we've now discovered. So when we discovered that, we were a bit depressed for a while, and then we thought, well, what can we do? How can we just engage with this? And we're working with a fantastic landscape architect, Michel Devine, who's in France. There are a few very, very good landscape architects, and he taught at Harvard for a number of years, and he was saying, well, what about Olmsted and late 19th century East Coast suburbs? You know, there's nothing wrong with them. You go to them, all you see are the trees. And they have a grid. The houses are more or less in the middle of the plot, and that's what you have. So that became our image for the project. And there is already a fantastic mature landscape, so, and things grow like mad here. That's another good thing. You plant something, and 5 years later, it's become something. So we had this idea that we would really celebrate this very bad urban plan and do an absolutely neutral road network, which was of course the most efficient, a kind of grid, and that the grid would be used for the apartment buildings in the south and for the houses. So all of the buildings, there's no idea of facades making urban space, it's a kind of completely open urban space with buildings in it. And in the north part, it's mostly private, the space, although there are a few big kind of alleys where the existing trees are particularly mature. And in the south part, it's common land, which is quite common in development, housing developments like this in France. And then we really concentrated our landscape ideas on the roads. So we have a kind of slightly hysterical amount of tree planting on the road, so that this idea When you're there, you don't see the buildings very much. You see the road, landscape structure, and then buildings in and amongst the trees. So that became the idea. It's the model.
There's a big protected forest already.
There's a lot of fantastic trees already on the site. And this is the south part of the site with these buildings and the car parking, but you can see there's a minimum of roads and the kind of atmosphere that you'll have there. So the big buildings, which are clad in, they're a bit like the mansard roofs of the apartment buildings in Bordeaux, so they're completely covered in tile, which, yeah, hopefully it'll give them a certain lightness. But then these layers of planting along the road. Very efficient plans, I won't go into that. And this idea that there aren't really backs and fronts. There is a side where the entrance and the car park entrance is, but then it's really the same in all orientations. And then the north part of the site with the houses, much the same. One innovation is that this land, which is private land, will be planted by the developer and will be part of the deeds that you don't then cut down the tree in front of your house to kind of build up this density. And then we sort of developed, we went slightly crazy on this, a kind of range of houses. The developer normally has the Saint-Tropez and the Nice and the Biarritz, you know, and they're the same basic house with different frilly bits on them. And we tried to do houses that were a little bit more fundamentally different. So houses which were very wide on their site, or houses that were long, and then saw what different sort of lifestyle potential you had with this orientation. And then each house has a kind of special feature, like a double-height hall or a double-height living room or whatever. And then each house also comes in a four-bedroom and in a five-bedroom version. So you then have this sort of five types, big and small version of each type. So that's the happy people in their garden. And then each house, which is quite volumetrically taut, has a kind of outbuilding structure, which could be a trellis or a winter garden or a pool cabane or a front porch. That's the front, kind of looking and seeing the other ones beyond the landscape. And that's the different types with their outbuildings. Okay, it's the last project. This is not the project. This is a photograph by Helen Binet of Leverance's St. Mark's in Björkhagen, one of his two brick churches, which I don't know how many of you know about Leverance, but he was a great architect, contemporary of Asplund, actually, who lived until the late 60s, who I've written about and who's a great hero of ours, and who in his late projects, his projects had a kind of incredible material intensity. And this last project I'm going to show is a bit of a homage à Leverance, but maybe for different reasons. Something I love about this photograph, and it's exactly like this, is that Björkhagen means birch. What's Hagen mean? I'm not sure. But it's in a birch forest. And the way that the bricks are smeared with their mortar makes the building camouflage in with the birch trees. And that was, I think, quite an intentional thing on Leverance's part. And the building I'm going to show, which is the brick house, which is in West London, is also kind of camouflaged into its entirely brick surroundings. Not as clever, obviously, as blending in with the birch forest. So this is a house for a very special family who came to us about building them a house, and then we spent 2 years looking with them for sites. And they wanted to live on one floor, have one floor, 500 square meters, family house in central London where they could buy a coffee 24 hours a day. We couldn't find such a site, so in the end we found a site where they could do it on two floors. And it's a very difficult inner block site, surrounded by all the things that London has. So a kind of very bad mews development from the 70s, an Edwardian terrace, some 1930s apartments, a 1960s apartment, and no real conventional relationship to any, like, front or back relationships.
They have had big ambitions, and they're very modest people in a way. They don't like display, but they wanted a great house. And they were worried, I think, once construction started, that actually you won't be able to see the house, and will it have a sufficient representational aspect to it? But I guess what we talked about with them was that the interior would have this representational and almost public scale to it, and that's the way it would work. And as soon as the big space was cleared of its propping, they kind of understood that. So the building just fills into its site, like kind of liquid poured into the site, and it assumes the shape of the site, and it fills it. And then we worry afterwards how we get light into the piano nobile, where the living space is with roof lights and a few windows, and then the ground floor, which has the bedrooms, have courtyards. And the house is made totally out of brick, out of load-bearing brick, and the horizontal structures are concrete. And it's a kind of formal interest, but it was about the idea of the construction making this interior of the house was about, in a way, compensating for the fact that there were no views, that there was no aspect from the interior of the house. So that somehow when you were there, you really had to be somewhere. And I guess we had this intuition that by using that construction could give the spaces that energy in a way that plaster couldn't. Also, because the site's so constricted, brick in the end was rather a practical way of building because it isn't very big. We couldn't get craneage to the site, and so that was good too. But it's load-bearing brick. It's not a kind of cavity wall. It's what's called diaphragm wall construction. So there's a brick and another brick with buttresses between the bricks, and then air, which we filled with insulation. So it's a very stable construction, which is quite good at resisting outward thrust, which the horizontal structure is exerting on it a little bit. There were 22 party wall awards in this project. It took 8 months to negotiate them, and a lot of money to the party wall surveyor. So we had to do the wall sections before we even went out to tender, because there's something like 18 different structural conditions, and we had to draw all of them at 1 to 10 so that the party wall awards could be negotiated. So that's the ground floor. So you go through a porte cochere, up a ramp, which we made, to raise the piano nobile into a big living space, which is about 12 by 14 meters, which has a kitchen, kind of two living areas and a dining room, and then around the stair, a study where the television is. Or you go down the stairs or down a back stair, which is in this courtyard, to the ground floor where the bedrooms are. Bedroom floor is weirder, so it has three courtyards for the guest bedroom, for the two kids, for the master bedroom. And so the bedrooms look into the courtyards, and then the center of the plan has all of the storage and the bathrooms. But the hall space is really wide, and there's in various ways light coming down to it. It's very mysterious. And until it was built, nobody really knew what it would be like. Luckily, it's okay. Once we had this idea, we had to think, and this was rather late, we were still making these decisions, how are we going to make roof lights in the big space? We'd never made a roof light before. We're not huge fans of top light, but we didn't have a choice here. We developed this kind of faceted dome that gave a certain centrality to the living room. And then we had to think, well, where can we put the roof lights? And we did many, many versions. And it was always about, well, is there enough of the dome? Have you not destroyed the dome by making this cut in it? You know, so this, because you can make the cuts and then the dome is like, it's flimsy or messy and it isn't giving this kind of centeredness. In the end, we arrived at this, and the cuts are like at the meeting point. So they're almost like pendentives, I guess, in a dome, in a funny sort of way. And they're also located in places that make sense. So above the kitchen, above one of the living areas, above the other one. And they kind of give a balance to the light with the big window at the dining room. This is a model when we finally got there. Something important. So now I'll just show you this picture. So this is the first section through this archway from the street under the Edwardian building. So you truly don't see the building from the main street into the space that leads to the living room and then down the stair. That's the entrance, rather modest. And that's the space which is before you get to the house proper, so it's like a carriageway, I suppose, except you're going uphill, with the back door. That's so the kids can sneak in without their parents seeing them, which was the point of building this house, because they lived in a five-story house, and the parents' complaint was they never saw their kids, and they were going to move out soon, and they wanted to have a few years bumping into them, by accident, at least. So this is looking the other way, and in a way, it's this point where the new structure begins, down the stair into the big living room. And this is, at that point, you kind of see these different holes, these different apertures in the roof. This is another section, looking towards the kitchen. So then you come into this room and everything is brick, the floor included in the major spaces. The back of the kitchen is in a white London courtyard brick, and then this is coriander, so there's sort of more reflection there. And then there's a mat of polished concrete, sort of terrazzo, defining this kitchen area, and that goes down the ramp. And that's where you've come up. So there's this brick, and then there's the idea of the concrete, which also, I mean, there's obvious references to 60s neo-brutalist architecture, you know, which was looking at vernacular architecture and construction and making something new, but hopefully it isn't as earnest as that. I mean, it isn't really displaying how it's a structure. It's being a bit quieter about that. But we were also interested in the potential of what we could do with the concrete. So where the concrete is flat, like under the dining room and in the ground floor, and here it's shuttered, normal but very carefully shuttered concrete. Where the concrete is vaulted, it's been bushhammered, so which exposes the aggregate and which makes the joint in the shuttering recede. And then where the cuts are made for the roof lights and where it's used on the floor, it's been polished, which exposes the aggregate in another way, like terrazzo. So it's all the same mix of concrete, but each of those post-treatments give it a different color and a kind of different feeling to it. And I guess it's about using these different ones that the smooth surfaces make the rough surfaces acceptable and vice versa. That's the dining room with the lighting. There's now curtains and carpets, and we're just now finishing the dining room table, finally, kind of a year and a half later. So this is going downstairs, so the stairs are also ground concrete. This big roof light at the head of the stair, which brings a lot of light into the hall, and there you can see the back stair in the courtyard. And then the hall has this kind of mysterious core of brick, and furniture. And the bedrooms all have translucent glazed doors, so you know when you're in the heart of the plan that there's light beyond. That's the master bedroom. It has furniture in it now, and we're just now going to make the precast planters, because it's big enough and it's south-facing, so we'll be able to plant that garden, or courtyard. And then the bricks, maybe you can see it better here. We were ready to start construction, and then we had this reserved matter about the bricks and lots of discussions with the planners, and we had hundreds of bricks in the office, and we had to choose which ones, because we thought we knew and then weren't sure. So in the end, we used on the interior a brick which is a bit like a Cambridge stock. It's actually what the West London Underground stations are built out of, the kind of turn-of-the-century ones. It's called a furnace buff or something like that, and it's quite a hard brick, not so crumbly, and it has some amazing colors in it. And on the outside, we use an overburnt version of quite an ordinary builder's brick, which blends in quite well with dirty London stocks. But both of the walls have the same mortar. So the mortar is a pure lime mortar with white sand, so there's no cement in it, so the building doesn't have expansion joints. It moves. If it needs to move, it's going to be in the joints. And the effect of On the inside, the bricks and the mortar are quite close, so the walls feel more monolithic. And then on the outside, the mortar joints feel like threads in a fabric.
And yeah, in the end, it feels right. This is the master bathroom, which they really like. It's like going into a cave, they say, and it's very relaxing. And then this is on the other street. There is a back door. We couldn't make the front of the house here because they don't own a kind of 800 mil strip of land between this wall and the pavement, so we're not allowed to enter there. But that's where the master bedroom courtyard is. And you can see on the outside, this roof feels less massive, less cave-like, and more like a tent, actually. That's it, I think. Yeah. That's all. Thank you.
Actually, I think you could have called that lecture Beautiful Objects rather than Specific Objects,
yes.
But I'm
far
too modest to just say. I said at the beginning that in a way it's a sort of a collision or a fusion of the ordinary and the special, and I think it's a great shame that whilst that last building was shortlisted for the highly prestigious National Sterling Prize, that it didn't win, and what won was just a very special building. But anyway, questions, please. So,
very nice, you know. It's absolutely right what you're saying, and this happy people and the idea that architecture on its own makes a better world is one of the great modernist myths, and I don't believe Mies ever believed that his architecture made a better world. He believed he was making beautiful buildings, and that's the best he could do. And you don't, you know. I'm teaching now in a school of sociology, and I think sociology has much more about finding out why people are content or discontent than architecture. Architecture, and that's why I call the lecture Specific Objects, the architect only has power over the production of an object, of an artifact, physical artifact. It's the only thing we have control over. Of course, one can be critical towards the program, and we are, and we like working on projects like the Nottingham project, where we're involved in developing a program if it's something we know something about, contemporary art, which, you know, over the last 10 years we have gained a certain knowledge about. But other projects were given a brief, and that can be fine as well, as long as you can live with what the brief is. To me, those images are so incredible that you wonder how they're still persuasive, you know, because all you need to do is go to a big office development with the Costa Coffees downstairs, you know, and the Costa Coffee next to the Starbucks, next to the Gap, isn't enough to make everybody, you know, go to heaven. It's like people are just going about their normal days. They might be having a coffee, they might be happy, they might be sad. And I think the test of architecture and urbanism is when it's empty and when it's raining,
That's the test, you know, and I think you really see what a city's about when it's empty, which I think a lot of artists have commented on. There's writers who talk, I can't think who, I used to quote somebody who said that, but when I first came to London, I remember I used to love cycling around the city of London on Sundays, and now I go running very early on the weekend so I can do that, and it's empty. It's not as nice as it was when I first got here 20 years ago, but it's too much construction going on, but it's empty, and it's like this incredible physical artifact, you know, which you're going through, and you feel small, but the buildings are, some of them are sublime, some of them are gross, and that is the city, and it has to sustain a certain life, but I don't think there's a precise relationship about the occupation and the life and the building. Okay, so that's why we do what we do. I know that wasn't your question. How do we persuade people? We're not that good at it. We are getting better and better at doing certain things. We have an expertise and a capacity at doing buildings for contemporary art and now more for historic art. And we can very quickly get the confidence of curators and directors of museums because we don't bullshit, because our work isn't about empty aesthetic rhetoric. It's about the display of art, which we are passionate about. It's something that Peter and I really have in common, is a great interest in contemporary art. I have a lot of friends who are artists, and so, you know, I'm kind of aware of what works and doesn't in their minds in terms of installing work. And if you can get that confidence, and that it's exciting, that isn't some kind of retrograde safe option, because I don't believe it is. I don't believe that pushing the envelope to the ever more ridiculous is radical. You know, I don't believe that. I believe that looking at history and looking at what's now and imagining what could be, all of those things can be radical, they can be conservative. You know, I don't believe that crazy forms are radical. They obviously aren't. If anything, they're reactionary, I think, because they're kind of trying so hard to represent a kind of vision which clearly there's no political energy to deliver at the moment, you know. So yeah, you in different ways, but without it not using rhetoric, I suppose. But I am amazed at that rhetoric, and it does, I'm amazed that it still has such currency, because you could do so many test cases now that proves it doesn't. You know, that the building filled with millions of, you know, people, that they're not all happy like they were in the section.
Another question.
I really like the specific objects you present as late as an architect, but did you actually mention the word ethics and ethical position?
Further to the question. The last question. I want to know, what is your ethical position towards that little town in France? Mm-hmm. Do you think that actually architects are not able to do anything about codes? I mean, what is your ethical position towards the suburb, more clearly, actually? Thank you.
I think we do practice ethically, although it would take a long time to make that argument, I suppose. But specifically to that project, because I think that's a kind of, it's a specific question. The suburbs are problematic environmentally. That's the only problem I have with suburbs. You need a car to get to suburbs, and that's a big problem. I don't think in terms of land use, especially in France, suburbs are problematic. France has an enormous area of agricultural land, way too much. It's not like Britain, with the green belt kind of going like this between kind of, you know, voraciously expanding urban and suburban areas. France has a big agricultural economy. It's a real problem, its agricultural economy. It's too big. It's highly subsidized. I'm not suggesting it should disappear, because they produce a lot of very good food in France, but also they produce Granny Smith apples and things like that, which they could not produce. And so there is a lot of land Like, the land that we're building on is not agricultural. It hasn't been for 50, like, since the war. It's kind of leftover land. And, okay, the code. We have other projects in France where we are doing a master plan which is able to change the urban plan. So we can put the houses closer together in order to make bigger public spaces, etc. But I think that that project in Villeneuve, as it took us a long time to get our minds around where the generosity lay in it, but I think if it continues to develop, and this idea of the landscape, which the developer we're working with, they're not great developers, but there are other projects, what you notice is how good the landscape is, you know, that they maintain it, and there's a kind of legal ownership structure that maintains the landscape, there's irrigation, etc. I think it could be a pleasant place for families to live, you know, and it's middle class. They're not big, the houses, and so it's okay. It's very ordinary, and what will be special is being in this setting, which is almost like a forest, which is an extension of an existing forest. That's what will be special. The suburban thing, that there's a problem in terms of transport, but you know, I don't know what will. But you know what's shocking, when you go to Holland, which has a great public transport system, and you visit the housing that was done for Vinex, you know, they did 1 million homes between Rotterdam and Amsterdam in 10-year period. It's all suburban, and it's all served by cars. You have to take a car to get to your house. It's quite surprising, because you think Holland, great trains, between the cities, yeah, and then you have to drive. So everybody does, it's park and drive. I can hear you, but the walking is drowning you out.
I think beyond just the problem of transport and cars, I think there's something which is more important, which is also a problem with the cities as well as suburbs, is the growing of it. Mm-hmm. There's constant growth of both suburbs and cities, and there is no way that we're able to densify it or stop it. So in a way, the center, the relationship or the proportion of the center of the city to the outskirt it doesn't always exist or sustain in the same manner. And even when I saw your plan of the suburb, it still leaves a lot of a tendency that it can freely grow more. But then I think there is a need to stop it somewhere.
Have limits.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, in that situation, Bordeaux is a very dense city. And the center of Bordeaux it isn't really gentrified. Maybe it is. It's become very, very popular in the last 10 or 12 years. It's very expensive, the center. And then the other alternative, if you have money, is to buy a chateau. Because, of course, you have all the great wines, like within 5 minutes drive from our suburb is Graves. So they're, it's incredible. And the chateau producing the best Bordeaux's. Right. And so there have been a lot of options for rich people, and they've sort of been taken up. So there is a big demand for this kind of middle class with some affordability. You know, there's always 20% social housing in every French project, and it's integrated. But of course, I agree with you. It would be, that's a kind of at the territorial level, it would be good. And in German cities, when you fly over Germany, you see that. It's very, very strict, the limits of the built areas, whether it's a town or a city. There's the city, it has an edge, and then there's the country. And that's why if you're in Stuttgart or in Munich or wherever, you can cycle in 10 minutes to the countryside. And that's the kind of, after the war, they had this policy, and it's very popular, because it works very well with the kind of leisure lifestyle of maybe after work in the summer being able to go for a run or for a cycle or whatever. And it's very impressive. It's unusual, though, because you go to Switzerland and the villas continue along Lake Zurich until you get, you know, to the Alps, really. And it's different.
In fact, I've been in Holland for the last 2 years. I just came 20 days back in this country. And I think there's one more problem which the VNEX faces, and it is a failure, is because also it's just unifunctional.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you just see endless number of
houses. But you know, in Holland, the discussion is very interesting. In Holland, they also had a lot of agricultural production, which they're reducing now. And so they have land which is empty, but with polders that is keeping it dry.
Yeah.
And they can't live with that. It's impossible.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they have two options. They build on it, or they destroy the polders and flood the land. Because for them, the defense of the land from the sea is such a culturally deep thing that they can't stand having empty land.
Yeah.
So they have to function there. That's why they're such functionalists. They have to fill everything. And it's a serious thing. They realize this. Because they had an idea about having a national park a few years ago, and it didn't happen. It was made them nervous.
No? That's true.
You have to go to Belgium to see a bit of empty land.
Absolutely. I think we're going to have to end it there. I know there are people who need to get away. But Adam, thank you very much indeed. And we look forward to seeing you all again, hopefully on the 14th of November with Ricky Burdett's lecture. But meanwhile, thank you, Adam.